Good evening. It's Saturday, April 18th, 2020. Coming up, demonstrators across the country send a symbolic message to the Trump administration.
We're bringing body bags.
The COVID-19 pandemic causes many to re-examine factory farms and the meat and dairy industries as a whole.
Modern factory farms here in the U.S. are truly biocatastrophes in the making.
And COVID cases are on the rise in homeless shelters in San Francisco.
We've got folks who are, you know, who are unhoused that are twice as likely to end up in the ICU.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News.
Governments around the world are trying to figure out when and how to ease the restrictions designed to control the coronavirus pandemic in the midst of rising unemployment and with many of their citizens struggling to make ends meet. Mandatory lockdowns to stop the spread of the new virus, which has so far infected almost 2.3 million people and for which there is no vaccine, have brought widespread hardship. In a joint statement today, foreign ministers from 13 countries, including Canada, Brazil, Italy, and Germany, called for global cooperation to lessen the economic impact of the pandemic. The statement was also backed by a number of other countries. The Trump administration did not join in the call, and the debate in the U.S. has taken on partisan tones ahead of the fall presidential election.
This weekend, demonstrators are delivering a symbolic message to the Trump administration in the form of homemade body bags, which they're delivering to Trump properties across the country. Barry Thornton is a spokesperson for Refuse Fascism and is participating in San Francisco's action while observing social distancing protocols. He says it's time for the Trump-Pence administration to go.
We're bringing body bags. We're doing it because this Trump-Pence regime is killing people. That they were already fascist, in our view, before the COVID-19 epidemic struck, and they have gotten much worse. They're killing people, and we are dramatically protesting that. We're observing social distancing. We uphold social distancing, and we will be masked. We will have gloves. We will not be close together, but we are going to deliver this message because we think it's extremely important that this be resisted and under difficult conditions.
And talk about how you feel that the Trump-Pence regime is killing people.
Well, I mean, you can talk about the prisons. Trump has refused and has opposed efforts that some governors have done to release at least some of the prisoners. It's impossible to observe social distancing in the prisons. It's impossible to observe social distancing in the detention camps for immigrants and for refugees. People who've committed no crime are held under conditions where this disease can spread like wildfire. And we could talk about the way testing has been handled and continues to be handled, which jeopardizes health workers, as well as the unavailability of medical equipment for the health workers who are putting their lives on the line. All of that adds up to this didn't have to be this way. It is this way, and it has everything to do with this anti-science fascist agenda that this regime is all about.
And when regarding COVID-19, we've seen Trump really be all over the map, going from really downplaying how serious it is. And when he's asked a critical question by a journalist, he tends to attack the asker of the question. It seems like in some ways he's really rushing to open the economy, even against the recommendations of places like the World Health Organization. What do you make of all of this?
You can see he's been pressed by his advisors to go even as far as he has to support social distancing. He's upholding these Trump, pro-Trump protesters in Michigan and now California and other states who were out there in egregious violation of social distancing, calling for the economy to be reopened. He's calling on people to liberate those states. This is dangerous in itself. These people are out with Confederate flags. This is a fascist movement raising its head. That's what we're seeing. And what we're doing in our protest is the exact opposite. We're acting in the interests of humanity. We're upholding and promoting social distancing. We are saying this regime must go out now. It needs to happen as soon as possible.
And this is a national action. People across the country are doing this. What would it look like? How would we operationalize this idea of ousting this regime?
What we've seen in many countries before this epidemic, huge mass protests involving at times hundreds of thousands of people, Chile, Puerto Rico, many places in the Hong Kong, many places in the world, are what we need. We need a mass movement from the people that says, in the name of humanity, we will not accept a fascist America, that stands up to this. The most important thing that people can do is to take to the streets. Now, you can't do that in the kind of way that's required. We're trying to work within the constraints of social distancing. We have a statement of conscience on our website, which we encourage people to read and sign and spread. Our website is refusefascism.org. We urge people to find a way to express opposition to this.
That's Barry Thornton from Refuse Fascism.
Most of the discussion surrounding the coronavirus has been about the nature of the disease, how many people have been infected, and how the pandemic is affecting the economy. But many on the left believe that the disease reveals just how bankrupt the capitalist system is. Jeff Mackler is with Socialist Action.
Here you have an epidemic threatening the whole world with people starving and standing on food lines, and yet farmers are dumping hundreds and thousands of pounds, if not millions of pounds of chicken and pork and eggs in ditches because there is no market for them. It reminds me of the stories I used to hear about the Great Depression in the late 20s, early 30s, where farmers were burning mountains of potatoes while people were starving. What it says is that we have enough food to feed the world, and yet we can't feed the world or won't feed the world under a system where food and profit are inseparable. It's the same thing with medical care. It exposes a situation where even today, the vast majority of people can't be tested or have masks or gloves to protect themselves from this horrible virus.
Haven't governments at different levels been doing things to try to help people survive? Things like delaying evictions and mortgage payments, for example?
Yes and no. The first reaction was the 76-0 vote in the U.S. Congress to allocate $2.3 trillion. But there was no breakdown of that 2.3 trillion. But as the facts come in, the vast majority goes to the corporate elite, to, for example, the airline industries like Boeing and others, where bipartisan votes voted to allocate billions and billions of dollars to these corporations, even though no one is flying, but just to keep them solvent. The same thing with the Federal Reserve. That is now allocated another $4 trillion for a total of almost $7 trillion in bailouts to keep the economy going. That is to fund the large corporations who get the lion's share. We have a situation where the government has allocated the equivalent of all monies produced by the GDP in 3 months. The entire GDP of the United States, for example, gross domestic product, is $22 trillion, and the Congress and Federal Reserve have already set plans in motion to pay back the failing corporations to the tune of the full amount that they will lose. As far as the money for unemployment insurance and rent, this is a temporary delay. This is not a forgiveness. This is a delay in foreclosures. But the money is still owed to the corporations, to the banks, and to the mortgage holders. That is, people are going to have to pay eventually by going into debt or deeper debt than they have in recent decades.
That's Jeff Mackler of Socialist Action. He's also a presidential candidate in 2020.
Governor Newsom today announced an initiative to house California's homeless population during the coronavirus pandemic. The governor said the state has secured a total of 10,974 hotel rooms for the unsheltered and another 5,025 motel rooms, thanks to a partnership with Motel 6. A total of more than 4,200 homeless people are now staying in hotel rooms due to the virus. Newsom also announced that another 87 people died from the virus overnight, the highest number in the state since the pandemic started. The governor said, "The total number of deaths from the disease in California is now at 1,072. As cities and nations grapple with strategies to stop the spread of COVID-19, San Francisco is facing some extra challenges with managing a large homeless population. Homeless shelters are reporting an uptick in positive coronavirus cases, and advocates say it's a ticking time bomb for the city. KPFA's Lola Kamu reports.
The San Francisco Board of Supervisors passed an emergency ordinance this week to allow the mayor to secure 7,000 hotel rooms to house the city's homeless population. The ordinance grants Mayor London Breed the power to commandeer hotel rooms to house the city's most vulnerable population. The mayor initially resisted calls from homeless advocates to help curb the spread of the virus due to the logistical challenges. The city's largest shelter has reported that more than 100 of its residents have tested positive for the virus. Jennifer Friedenbach is the executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness. She says there's a double standard in San Francisco and that the unhoused have no way to practice proper social distancing in shelters.
Yeah, it's important to remember, you know, we are all connected. We've got folks who are, you know, who are unhoused that are twice as likely to end up in the ICU. There's been a lot of talk around worry about having enough ICU rooms, ICU beds for everyone. That should be thought about. You're also 2 to 3 times more likely to pass away. Homeless folks are part of the community. They're out there right now without an ability to wash hands, without an ability to watch the news, without restrooms to use. I mean, all of these are things that contribute to the spread of the virus. If we're able to move people into hotel rooms, they have all of that. And they're able to watch the news and keep up on the information on how we're supposed to be sheltering in place. And as this virus changes daily, they're able to wash their hands, use the restroom, use a shower. They could have food delivered to them, and that way they don't have to go outside. And if they do get sick, you know, we can have a rapid response in terms of making sure that they get assistance rather than being out there disconnected from health workers.
Friedenbach says the mayor's hotel vouchers fall short and that the situation is dangerous.
Yeah, so at the state level, we have a situation where the governor has moved forward on hotel vouchers, but that effort has fallen far short of what is actually needed and is really limited to hotel rooms for unhoused people who are COVID positive. Here in San Francisco, unhoused folks are faring slightly better, but the situation in San Francisco is they're still not doing hotel rooms for everyone who's unhoused. They're doing hotel rooms for folks who have tested positive, and most recently, although 4 weeks in, they've started placing vulnerable people out of shelters into hotels. That means that in San Francisco, there's still about 1,700 people in shelters that are in congregate settings where they're sharing bathrooms and in a situation where the virus has spread. In fact, at MSU South, the new numbers that are in demonstrate that the positive rates hit 74%. And that was the only shelter that they tested. So we don't know what the positive rates are on the other shelter or how fast this is spreading. But it's a very dangerous situation that is not to date changed.
Again, that was Jennifer Friedenbach, executive director with the Coalition on Homelessness. I'm Lola Komu, reporting for KPFA News.
Workers at an Oakland McDonald's walked off the job today to protest the company's failure to provide sick leave and masks and to enforce social distancing guidelines in the midst of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The workers also filed a complaint with the Alameda County Public Health Department, saying a failure to pay sick leave puts them in an impossible situation, sometimes forcing them to come in sick in order to take care of their families. The complaint alleges that McDonald's is behaving irresponsibly and putting workers and customers at risk of contracting or spreading COVID-19. Earlier this week, Governor Gavin Newsom ordered all food chain employers, including fast food companies, to provide 14 paid sick days to workers unable to work due to the COVID-19 crisis. And you are listening to the evening news on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and KPFA.org. With Sharon Sobota, I'm David Rosenberg. North Coast environmental activists may have scaled down their activities because of the coronavirus, but they're still very much involved in the struggle to preserve as much forest land as they can. Karen Pickett is with the Bay Area Coalition for the Headwaters. We asked her what North Coast forest defenders are up to in the midst of the pandemic. She talked about the latest tree sit and related activities.
It's in this area called Strawberry Rock, which is it's a long contested area, and the timber company keeps coming back to it, and the forest defenders keep coming back to it. But it's an area that is culturally important to the Yurok people up in that same area, and it's owned by Green Diamond Corporation that owns a lot of timberland in California and Oregon and Washington, and they're known for their clear cutting, and they've been filing logging plans in the habitat of threatened species like the spotted owl and the Pacific fisher. So that tree sit went up on April 1st, and so far as I know, it's still up now. And there's also a lot of forest monitoring going on, which has always been ongoing, but it's also kind of a solitary hiking activity. So that did not need to be curtailed, and people are monitoring the forest in the Rainbow Ridge area, a little south of Strawberry Rock, on land owned by the Humboldt Redwood Company in the Mattole River watershed.
The logging companies see themselves as providing an essential service during a time of crisis, but Pickett and other North Coast environmental activists are determined to somehow put a stop to what they regard as destructive and unnecessary logging practices.
The spread of coronavirus has disrupted the Pentagon's normal operations, including the U.S. Navy's operations in the Pacific. KPFA's Ann Garrison reports.
As of this broadcast, the USS aircraft carrier Chester Nimitz is docked at the Puget Sound Naval Shipyard in Bremerton, Washington. The shipyard is the centerpiece of Naval Base Kitsap, which also includes a nuclear weapons depot elsewhere in Kitsap County. The Nimitz is at the shipyard despite the Navy's plans to deploy it in the Pacific 10 days ago to relieve the USS Roosevelt. In a departure from the Navy's strategic norms, the Roosevelt is already docked at U.S. Naval Base Guam because of an outbreak of COVID-19 among its crew. The Nimitz and the Roosevelt are both nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, two of 11 in the U.S. Navy, each of which carry around 80 fighter jets. They are the largest aircraft carriers in the world, with a total combined deck space over twice that of all other nations combined. At the beginning of April, the U.S. Defense Department announced that 1,000 servicemen, military contractors, and other personnel had developed COVID-19, but at the same time ordered specific military installations worldwide to stop announcing new cases, particularly among their nuclear forces, for fear that military adversaries might exploit such information. These perceived adversaries are presumably Russia, China, and North Korea, all of which have Pacific coastlines. The Navy canceled the deployment of the USS Nimitz amidst a disagreement between the Pentagon and Navy brass about whether or not coronavirus had spread among its crew. On April 14, the Navy announced that the Nimitz would deploy, quote, shortly, unquote, without specifics. In any case, with the Nimitz at Naval Base Kitsap and the Roosevelt at Naval Base Guam, the Navy is not in its normal operational mode in the Pacific at this time. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Much has been made of the fact that COVID-19 started in a wet market in Wuhan, China. Many health experts and animal rights activists have been warning about the dangers of such live animal markets for quite some time, and now it's not unusual to hear calls to ban them altogether. But some experts go further than that. They say eating meat is the problem. Vivica Morris is the executive director of the Law, Ethics, and Animals program at Yale Law School. We asked her about the role eating meat plays in spreading disease and about whether enough is being done to prevent more major virus outbreaks.
Meat plays a big role in that it has a very outsized environmental impact in all sorts of ways. So first, through land use change and deforestation. Land use change is one of the primary drivers of a range of infectious disease outbreaks. And we know that, you know, meat, aquaculture, eggs, and dairy together are estimated to use something like 83% of the world's farmland. And in global disease hotspots, which tend to be tropical areas with rich wildlife biodiversity where these diseases are most likely to emerge, livestock farming is one of the primary drivers for converting tropical forests to pasture and agriculture. And so we've seen incidences like in the 1990s in Malaysia, a Nipah virus emerged, scientists think, as a result of the increase in size and density of pig farms along bat-rich areas of forest. And then likewise, in multiple continents, we've seen clearing tropical forests for agriculture and livestock grazing linked to increases of malaria occurrences. So there's that through land use and deforestation. A second way is through industrial factory farming. Factory farms really dramatically increase our risk of both highly drug-resistant bacterial pathogens and viruses like avian influenzas. So our modern factory farms here in the U.S. are truly biocatastrophes in the making. In these facilities, we're packing livestock animals for all or most of their lives, often by the thousands, into crammed living conditions that are perfect for viral and bacterial pathogens to develop and mutate and spread.
From what you've seen so far, what steps are being taken to prevent another outbreak of this type of virus? And do you think those steps are enough?
Currently, I think we tend to approach each pandemic independently and reactively, rather than looking at their shared underlying ecological drivers. And it makes a lot of sense that right now, given how severely people are suffering, that the priority is on saving lives right now, you know, as it should be. But we also need to be looking at these underlying drivers, because just reacting after, you know, a pathogen has already emerged simply isn't good enough in the age of pandemics in which we find ourselves. So I don't think we're doing enough in this regard. I think we need to do a lot more. And scientists estimate that animals carry over 600,000 unknown viruses with the potential to jump to humans. And we know almost nothing about most of those viruses. Of the viruses that do jump to us, some will be harmless, but others, like COVID-19, won't be. So to prevent future outbreaks like COVID-19 or potentially even worse outbreaks, I think that we have to treat planetary, animal, and human health as inseparable.
That's Favika Morris of the Law, Ethics, and Animals program at Yale Law School.
As many preschools in California are a month into their temporary closures and parents have been thrust into new roles as early childhood educators, many early childhood education teachers are now without work. Emil Delgado is the director of the Child Day School in Moraga and oversees the care and education of 80 children. Delgado talked about what life's been like for the students and staff at his school since it shut down on March 16th.
We haven't been able to provide a whole lot other than virtual, you know, Zoom meetings with the children and families, Facebook posts of story readings, but, they're preschool children, so there's not a lot they're getting from that.
So you are still doing contact in that way?
Yes, through Facebook primarily. I do, semi-weekly emails to the families and then the staff. Yeah, each individual staff will kind of post, I miss you messages or, song stories and whatnot on Facebook or virtual.
And so you're supported by families paying tuition. So how is that part impacted? Have tuition rates been lowered as people are not having in-person contact, or how is it working that way?
So I have no enrollment tuition-wise whatsoever. It's all voluntary. What I did this last month is I asked families, because a lot of them did reach out and said they're still getting paid. They want to make sure teachers get some level of income. So they have, we just kind of started a Venmo thing where we raised some money. So some teachers, all the teachers anyway, will divide it up equally. So the teachers will get some funds. But as far as our area, it's bigger than just our school. Every single school in that area that I know of, especially full-time care, they've all been forced to lay off their staff.
So how many staff were laid off at your particular center?
In my center, 8 are laid off, and then the other 8 are forced to collect unemployment. So everybody's basically laid off in some aspect or another. The only difference is some keep benefits or kind of furloughed, where the other half were completely laid off.
So you have a system where teachers will stay in touch with the students and it's completely voluntary as to whether or not families want to contribute something. Is that the deal?
Right. So this last month, I just started this about a week ago. So I've raised about, with these families, obviously, about $11,000 plus that I know of. And my plan, the staff actually don't know fully yet, but I'm going to mail them each a check individually, whether they're laid off or not. All 16 staff are going to get a check evenly distributed. And this is all voluntary through families. This has nothing to do with tuition or the school itself. So tax-free anyway.
And so you're in the La Mirinda area. Some of the families at the school are from affluent backgrounds. What are your worries about colleagues who might not have families who can step up and pony up in the same way that these families have?
I think the bigger concern at this point is, you know, once this goes past April and into May, there's going to be more layoffs, not necessarily our school, but just, you know, through the country and state, county and whatnot. My concern is everybody's going to find different work because they need to make some level of money at some point. So I'm worried we're going to lose these staff as time keeps going on and we don't have an actual end date in sight.
Anything you want families to keep in mind as they're kind of trying to homeschool and piece it together, or words of encouragement you might have for staff like yours who worked in centers similar to yours?
I would say just be patient when you're home. Try to be patient with those kids. And then when you're out and about, you know, just remember it's bigger than all of us. Just take what you need, leave what you don't, and just know that we're one giant community at this point.
That's Emil Delgado, the director of the Child Day School in Moraga.
As a clearer picture emerges of COVID-19's deadly toll on Black Americans, a growing number of medical professionals, activists, and political figures are pressuring the federal government to not just release comprehensive racial demographic data of the country's coronavirus victims, but also to outline clear strategies to blunt the devastation on African Americans and other communities of color. On Friday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released its first breakdown of COVID-19 case data by race, showing that 30% of patients whose race was known were Black. The latest Associated Press analysis of available state and local data shows that nearly one-third of those who have died are African American, with Black people representing about 14% of the population in the area covered in the analysis.
1 in 6 new complaints of domestic violence was made over a relaunched WhatsApp number in India. An NCW official told Al Jazeera on the condition of anonymity that the WhatsApp number had been out of use for some time, suggesting there could have been more complaints that never got through. The NCW relies on women to report domestic violence on its fixed helpline and through the post, two modes of communication that have been closed since India started its massive lockdown in late March.
Britain is at or near the peak of a health crisis in which more than 15,000 people have died, the fifth highest national death toll of a pandemic linked to at least 150,000 deaths worldwide. Data published today showed 15,464 people have died in British hospitals after testing positive for coronavirus, an increase of 888 in a 24-hour period. That increase is higher than recent days, but below the highest daily death toll of 980 seen just over a week ago. The government issued new guidance to hospitals on Friday, setting out that alternatives to fluid-repellent full-length gowns may need to be used, including reusable gowns or even long-sleeved laboratory coats.
Doctors in Japan are warning that the country's medical system could collapse in the midst of another wave of new coronavirus cases. Officials say the emergency rooms have been unable to treat some patients with serious health conditions due to the extra burden caused by the virus. One ambulance carrying a patient with coronavirus symptoms was turned away by 80 hospitals before he could be seen. Japan, which initially appeared to have the virus under control, passed 10,000 confirmed cases today. And the weather in the San Francisco Bay Area, low of 53 this evening, partly sunny tomorrow with highs in the low 60s. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the 50s this evening, partly sunny with a high of 70 for tomorrow. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Ann Garrison and Lola Akamu for helping to prepare tonight's news. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.